Javi, and thank you for inviting me. So I don't often write about yoga, but I've worked as a yoga teacher for about 11 years and practiced yoga for almost 20 years. And but I work as an academic philosopher in the field of phenomenology of the body. So in this talk, I'm kind of bringing these two aspects of my life together, which is something I've actually never really done before. But when Javi invited me to come here to speak about the breath, I thought, since I have this kind of expertise, I suppose, in introspective body practices and have done years of practice in pranayama and controlled breathing, that it might be interesting to reflect philosophically on and phenomenologically on these sorts of practices, and also useful for the purposes of this research project, I suppose. So the title of the talk is The Phenomenology of Breath Awareness and Controlled Breathing in Introspective Body Practices, and in this talk I'm going to discuss two distinct but related themes. So firstly, the use of phenomenology or the phenomenological method in examining the body and bodily experiences such as controlled breathing in introspective body practices. And second, using the phenomenological approach to examine pranayama or the practice of controlled breathing in yogic practices. In short, I want to offer a brief sketch of what a phenomenology of pranayama might look like and point to some further questions regarding the use of phenomenology as a method when considering what we might call spiritual or embodied practices. So I wanted to start with the bigger question of phenomenology and somatic awareness in general. So considering the use of phenomenology as a means to cultivate somatic or body awareness, or as a means to become aware of internal bodily events and reflect on the claim that this sort of awareness can have ameliorative potential in terms of physical and spiritual health and well-being. So this would be distinct from a phenomenological account of the effects of breath or breathlessness on the body and action or lived experience, which Javi outlined in her talk earlier. But using phenomenology as a method to attend to the breath itself, to attend to the sensations and the experience of the breath as a distinct experience in itself. So the reason I wanted to start here is partly to respond to recent criticisms by the somatic philosopher Richard Schusterman, who in his recent books, I think both published by Cambridge University Press, Body Consciousness and Thinking Through the Body, he has argued that phenomenology, and particularly the work of thinkers like Merleau-Ponty, Husserl, and Sartre, ignores somatic awareness as a component of lived experience. Schusterman argues that despite making important developments in theorizing the body and overcoming the limiting dualism that has been traditionally dominant in Western philosophy, phenomenological thinkers like Merleau-Ponty acknowledge the body only to efface it once again through their emphasis on outward-directed action and perception, the emphasis on the lived experience directed outward to the world. In short, phenomenology, Schusterman argues, wholeheartedly affirms the background status of the body, with proper functioning occurring when the body is silent, tacit, and anathematized entity which makes world direction, action, and perception possible. So arguing that phenomenology reaches a limit in its privileging of outward-directed intentionality, Schusterman claims for the usefulness of an inward-directed attention. And this attention explores and brings conscious regard to things like breathing, posture, alignment, and body sensations that include things like the sensation of the viscera, sensations on the surface of the body, such as pain, tingling, itching, sensations that accompany emotional and mental states, and the sensations concomitant to respiration, among others. Schusterman's overall claim resonates strongly with the principles behind Eastern body practices such as yoga, and in short, he argues that attending to these sorts of inward sensations and cultivating this sort of somatic consciousness through introspective body awareness has potential in terms of knowledge, performance, and creative self-fashioning. So Schusterman's claim, and he's very explicit about this, is that the heightening of the soma's conscious critical self-examination by cultivating introspective body awareness can enhance and enrich experience in order to make it, as he says, more rewarding. Schusterman rejects phenomenology as a methodology to attend to one's own soma, and instead develops his own theory and method, which he calls soma aesthetics. And what I would suggest is that Schusterman's rejection of phenomenology is rather hasty, and that within the phenomenological tradition, there are plenty of resources to help us to attend to the body as a site of phenomena and experience in its own right. And although Schuster is critical of the phenomenological approach for not recognizing the potential significance and usefulness of an inner directed attentiveness, it should be noted that this line of thought has been existent in the phenomenological literature for several decades. So starting with Husserl, we see an explicit thematization of the body as a unique site of experience and somatic field. And the sensations of this type of bodily awareness would include what Husserl has termed sensuous feelings, which he characterizes as sensations such as pleasure, pain, or well-being, and corporeal indisposition. Despite often being outside of conscious awareness, these sensations are a phenomenological constant of bodily experience. As the phenomenologist Drew Leader explains, and this is a quote from My Absent Body, my body is always a field of immediately lived sensation. Its presence is fleshed out by a ceaseless stream of kinesthesis, cutaneous and visceral sensations, defining my body's space and extension and yielding information about position, balance, state of tension, desire, and mood. Perceiving this somatic field requires a type of awareness that is qualitatively different from world-directed attention that characterizes the majority of conscious experience. Turning conscious attention to bodily tactile feeling and to proprioception, which could be understood as our inner bodily sense, is essential to heightening somatic awareness of the inner sensations and realities, which are often the silent background of the somatic field. So for instance, the contemporary Husserlian phenomenologist and somatic practitioner Elizabeth Behnke recommends a type of awareness which she calls this sensing from within, to contrast with the separative seeing, which we utilize in ordinary perceptual relations with the world. So Behnke writes, what is required for this phenomena itself is thus a peculiar shift of consciousness from experiencing an object known as my own lived body to actively living in this body sense, in order to sense the internal flux which forms what she calls a background microkinesis. This style of inner awareness does not focus on world direction, action, and perception that Behnke claims both Husserl and Merleau-Ponty refer to with the phrase, I can. Instead, she argues that this sensing from within has a practical purpose, which resonates with Schusterman's own arguments on the utility of somatic awareness. So in another paper, she writes, the point is to retrieve our own ongoing self-shaping from anonymity and to take some measure of kinesthetic responsibility for it, especially with regard to our habitual posture as the tacit standard from which the limits and leeway of our bodily possibilities as a whole are gauged. So in short, the idea is something like phenomenology is a method that can be used to reflect on the body introspectively and to attend to the body as a unique site of sensation and experience. And furthermore, as the work of Behnke suggests, this might have some sort of therapeutic potential. So phenomenology is about examining experience. So in this sense, phenomenology demands a lucid experience of the investigator's own bodily field. So to do this sort of phenomenology of introspection, one must in fact do a phenomenology of introspection. And it is this precisely this conscious inward turning of attention that is the method that is utilized in introspective body practices like yoga or meditation, among others, or many others. So it is worth mentioning some parallels between what we might call the phenomenology of introspection and the methods of many Eastern body practices such as yoga, meditation, Zen practices, Tai Chi, and so on. And in fact, there is a kind of large literature, a comparative literature, drawing parallels between phenomenology and Buddhism and other Eastern practices in particular. Okay, so phenomenology has been likened to Eastern introspective practices in that through a particular type of attentiveness, there is a potential for an awakening, similar to the insights gained through body practices like meditation. So phenomenology as a method offers access to new conceptions of experience that reveal important existential truths, existential truths which can elucidate the structures of existence and of lived experience. So this is the idea that phenomenology can give us this new perspective on ourselves, a sort of awakening. The type of attentiveness in phenomenology that gives access to these insights is achieved through the phenomenological reduction or the epoche. through which Husserl finally claims that the world must be lost in order to be regained. So this reduction, or the epoché, operates through leaving aside or bracketing social, cultural, scientific, and other assumptions that could otherwise taint or color our observations, and attending to the pure phenomenon as they are experienced. So performing the epoché, according to Husserl, frees us from the natural attitude, and we can attend to the phenomena without these experiences being colored or overwritten by social, cultural, or other expectations. So after performing the epoché, we can turn attention to the body and discover various modes of body awareness or body consciousness. So Sean Gallagher, an American phenomenologist and cognitive scientist, in a 2011 review of Schusterman's book, Body Consciousness, outlines four levels of body awareness, and I'll just share them here. It's kind of useful. So firstly, the body can be unconscious, or the body is known, or sorry, is more or less unobserved, unknown and unobserved. The body can become part of conscious perception, so we are aware of the body, but it stays marginal or recessive in awareness. So like I have an awareness of the position of my legs, but I'm not attending to that awareness at the moment. Explicit awareness, so that we can become mindfully aware of the body through proprioception or vision, so observational somatic awareness, so I can look at my legs and have some, you know, an observation of their position or what they're doing at the moment. And then this fourth mode of awareness is what's of interest here. This is mindful awareness of the body, but also reflectively or metacognitively aware that we are aware of the body. So there's a kind of hyper or reflection on the reflection. So the fourth level here corresponds to the type of awareness that is cultivated in introspective body practices, particularly in types of yoga and meditation practices. And it is a reflective attending to the body and breath that is normally called the witness position or witness consciousness. And this involves a shift of attentiveness where one no longer identifies with experience but takes an impartial observer's point of view on that experience. So Richard Rosen, a pranayama teacher, explains in his book, The Yoga of Breath, the witness engages the outer and inner worlds on their own terms and lets them speak in their own words. It's present-centered with no memories of the past or concerns of the future, or about the future. The witness is the pure light of our consciousness, who sees the contents but who can't be seen itself. It's in us merely as an onlooker who, in all cognition, present as its innermost nucleus, looks on at worldly action and at its illusions without being in the least mixed up in it. And here we clearly see the resonances to the position of the epoché, or the position we come to when we form the reduction. So where phenomenology differs from Eastern practices and from Richard Schusterman's own accounts concerns regarding somatic awareness is that while phenomenology attends to experiences in order to describe them as a means to cultivate a certain type of intellectual knowledge, Eastern practices argue that attending to experiences is a means to self-cultivation and self-realization and can lead to spiritual rather than intellectual growth. However, what both approaches reveal is the inseparability of body and mind. So through taking either the position of witness consciousness or through employing the phenomenological reduction, what is exposed and described both in phenomenology and the Eastern traditions is the non-dualistic nature of body and mind. So the body-mind is a holistic system where one cannot be meaningfully separated from the other. Inner attentiveness reveals that the body and mind are in a co-constitutive relation. The mind constitutes the nature of the body, while the body constitutes the nature of the mind, more or less. As Tom Sparrow notes in his very recent book, Plastic Bodies, I'll put the quote up here, when we attend to sensation of the physical body, we find that it does not present itself phenomenally as an object of consciousness, or as what Husserl calls an intentional object. Sensation is something that happens below the phenomenal level, so at best it is a mediated datum of consciousness. So in other words, phenomenological reflections reveals the material and which would be the body and the immaterial consciousness bound together, or a body-mind. And what Sparrow's reflections also point to is in fact the difficulty or the maybe the problematic nature of using phenomenological reflection to describe that which is the nature, to describe that which is the ground of that reflection in the first instance, but I won't get into that here. So what is of interest, of course, here is the role that the breath plays in this body-mind system. And this is where I think of a phenomenology of breath. And theories about breath control in the yogic tradition become potentially interesting. So in the yogic tradition, the breath is seen as the link between the body and the mind, or the bridge between the physical and the mental, or physical and body and the immaterial consciousness. The idea is that cultivating breath awareness and learning techniques to control the breath is an important means to self-realization and self-knowledge. And so Richard Rosen asserts that breathing reflects consciousness, and we can affect or influence consciousness by changing our breath. Breath and consciousness are just the flip sides of the same coin. In order to find out who is breathing, the first thing we need to do is to ask how we breathe. While bridging the physical and the mental, the breath is also the gateway to the spiritual. Breathing practice is seen in the yogic tradition as a key, if not the key, part of spiritual practice. The renowned Dutch sinologist Christopher Schipper writes in his essay on breath, "Spiritual exercise is closely tied to the breath. Calling on the main gods must be done in connection with breathing exercises." So to explore this link between the body, the mind, and spiritual pursuit, I'll turn now to the last part of the talk, which is something like phenomenology and pranayama, in order to briefly discuss what actually happens when we examine the breath phenomenologically or through the attentiveness of the witness consciousness. So there are obviously breathing practices in many other traditions, but this is a tradition I know, so I'll discuss it briefly. So what is pranayama? So pranayama is commonly translated as breath control and can be understood to be a type of voluntary respiration. Pranayama is the practice of controlled breathing combined with breath awareness through the witness position in the yoga tradition. It is composed of two words. So pranayama is composed of prana and ayama. And prana is usually translated to mean something like life force or life energy or breath of life, while ayama means to stretch, extend, restrain, stop, expand, or lengthen, and is usually translated as control. So we get the two terms breath control. So pranayama is central to the yogic tradition and system and is used as a means, firstly, of self-inquiry, the idea that at looking at how we breathe, we begin to understand something about who we are. Self-transformation. Since the yogis consider breath and consciousness to be two aspects of the same thing, the idea is that when we change the breath in pranayama, we have the capacity to change who we are, or our state of being, our state of mind. And lastly, self-realization. The idea that our individual breath can become one with the universal life force, or the great breath, or in other words, we can reach something like enlightenment or transcendence or the release from our karmic debt through breathing practices. And I think Petri or someone called it nothingness in these mystical traditions. So beyond these more esoteric claims about pranayama are more practical claims around the benefits of controlled breathing practices. So in the yogic literature, the benefits of pranayama, or the physiological benefits, abound. These include things like benefits to the psyche, so cultivating a steady mind, strong willpower, sound judgment, and numerous physiological benefits. So things apparently like improving digestion and elimination from the body, opening the sinuses to improve the quality of respiration, curing disease and conditions, nervous disorders, indigestions, coughs and fever, and so on. And when we turn attention to the breath, we see that the breath has a unique status in the body. And this is something that Harvey mentioned. While it's also, while it's something that's out of our conscious awareness much of the time, it's also something that we can consciously control. So it can be a tacit background to our functioning and experience, but it is also, the breath is both unconscious, but it happens in the background outside of our conscious awareness, while it is also something that we can control with our conscious intention, so we can override the control of the breath. And it is in this way that the breath is considered a link or a bridge between body, or the preconscious aspects of the self, and the conscious mind. And it is on this point that we can, the idea that we can influence consciousness through the breath has some traction. Furthermore, as breath is about controlling prana or the universal life force, the breath is also seen as the link between the individual and the universal. And indeed, this idea of a lack of separation between inner and outer or subject and object is made tangible when we think of the breath or breathing as a constant flux of inner and outer, and that there is no strict boundary to the human body. Instead, there is a constant exchange between self and world, and the breath signals our inseparability to the outer world. And this idea resonates strongly with some of Merleau-Ponty's ontology of the flesh in his later writings. Okay, so I'm running out of time, but I'll just briefly go through a kind of crude phenomenology of the breath very quickly here. So when we turn attention to the breath, so if we actually attend to our breathing experience, we see that it's composed of three parts. We have an inhalation, an exhalation, and retention. And in the classical yoga text, the Yoga Sutra by Patanjali, we see the identification of these three phases of the breathing cycle. So we have exhalation or external breath, and breathing out, inhalation or internal breath, breathing in, or retention or fixed or stopped breath. So we can hold the breath in, or we can also exhale and hold the breath out. These are, of course, correspondent to our everyday experience of breathing. And when we consider that the retention can be a breath held in or an exhale with the breath held out, we see that the breath has four phases. For Patanjali, these phases of the breath are in turn regulated by three further aspects of breath: place, time, and number. So place refers to the location in the body where the breath is directed, so we can breathe to the chest, to the ribs, to the belly, and to the back body, and so on. Time refers to the duration or length of the inhalations and exhalations, and the number is the number of repetitions of the breathing cycles. So the various techniques of pranayama or controlled yogic breathing utilize the four phases of breath, along with the three aspects of breath, to produce certain states of consciousness in the body. And in the yogic tradition, this is described and hence experienced as a flow of energy or prana within the body. So the various types of practices, and there are numerous practices, and I was considering leading one here, but I don't think it's maybe appropriate. We can maybe do it after. I've run out of time. So through the practice, if anyone's tried different pranayama practice, the effects are very tangible. So the effects in the state of mind and the feeling in the body are almost immediate and very tangible. So in the yoga tradition, these are described, the effects of the practice are described as the movement of energy. So you can quite tangibly feel, if you'd like to use that vocabulary, the movement of energy in the body or different types of energy in the body. Okay, so then just to finish, loads of questions obviously arise, and I haven't written them on my paper. So can phenomenology provide a means to adequately describe the breath? So is it actually possible to attend to the breath phenomenologically? Can phenomenology provide a means to adequately describe the spiritual aspects of controlled breathing? Can one reflect on the breath and breathing practices theoretically, or is there a necessary existential component? And I obviously think there's no point in doing the theory without the practice. You need to have the experience if you want to attend to the breath. Does the phenomenology of pranayama reveal any insights with respect to the characteristics of what we might call regular breathing or unattended breath? Does practicing pranayama have health benefits, physical or psychological health benefits? And do we need to train the breath in order to have the conceptual or phenomenological tools to understand it? And I think I'd like to end on that question, because I think in my experience as an academic phenomenologist and also as a body practitioner, there's often quite a gap between doing phenomenology as an academic discipline and actually attending to experience and attending to the body. So thank you.
Observe breathing without controlling it, which becomes progressively more subtle. sort of thing. It's like, is it actually possible to observe a breath purely?
Without just attending to sensation.
Without trying to change it.
Oh, I see.
So my question is about that.
Yeah, interesting. I suppose when I was, when I think about the training I did through body practices to attend to the breath, it was through meditation practice where the practice was to attend to sensation. So first it was like, feel the sensation on your lip, feel the sensation in your nostrils. So accessing the experience of the breath was through the experience of sensations in the body. So the sensation is the ribs are expanding. So attending to breath without attending to sensation to me seems impossible. I don't know, we can talk about it after. And then whether or not you can have a breath without, attend to the breath without changing the nature of the breath. Yeah, I don't know. Have you had that experience?
We play around with it.
Yeah. But I think the nature, and this is like the nature of phenomenology. Once you attend to something, you change the nature of it necessarily, I suppose. So maybe it's the same when we think about the breath. Yeah. Yeah, good question. Thank you.
I'm afraid we're out of time.